You want me to turn the thing on?
Yeah, let's go ahead. You want me to send the tweet? I composed something.
Of course you did. It's on. I like how it's a nice low res image.
Oh,
too.
Well, like it would have been better.
He does a lot of growling and a little bit of talking, and I don't think his mouth ever moves.
No. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Mr. Johnson is his father.
He does not exactly get much to do other than be still in a body scanner for a while to pose, I guess.
He acts a little bit in some of the flashbacks earlier, but...
You mean like the 2 minutes at the start of the movie narrated again by Oded Fehr?
Yeah, they have that theme where they've got these sort of like parables that they're telling, which are meant to, I don't know, impart some sort of wisdom or something, or just stories from the Egypt Bible. And then, you never really hear what he's saying because it's all covered up with voiceover, but then... A lot of ridiculous things happen.
Yeah, one or two. This movie is a nonstop string of ridiculous events that occur one after the other with very little time in between, mercifully, for you to ruminate on what you've just witnessed before you're moving on to the next thing.
And a lot of one-upsmanship from the first movie, which also actually includes, what, like, I don't know, maybe like a tenth of the movie is... Just footage from the first movie?
Well, not just footage from the first movie, but also like retellings of events from the first movie. Like he's retconning things in here that were not part of the first movie.
Yeah, it's intercut. It's nice. It's we're seeing the full story now.
Yeah, nice is a word I would not really have used. But wait. Were you perhaps being sarcastic?
Probably.
Oh, well, in that case, yes, very nice. No, yeah. Oh man, I don't. Steven Summers is there again to do the thing, like he did the first time.
It's almost like he said, "I wish in that first movie I would have done like twice as many things. So I'm just gonna do those things again from the first movie, and then add a bunch of other stuff on top of it."
Well, he also like adds more destiny prophecy, like meant to be crap, than was there the first time. And that was basically the whole thing about the first movie was it was prophecy meant to be destiny stuff. So to have him go the extra mile of inventing a whole other thing with the reincarnations and the fact that Brendan Fraser has a special tattoo because he was always a magi or whatever. It's just like these were not part of the first film, really,
for good reason. So yeah what were the extra ones? He grew up in an orphanage, and he has a special tattoo, which means he is a magi, which is also what Oded Fehr is, and his job is to protect the pharaoh and stuff. And then you've got Evelyn, who is the reincarnation of Nefertiti, apparently, even though she's English. And then,
well, her mom was from Egypt. She says that in the first film.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. That really matters in the context of
I'm sure
of
Nefertiti
this.
Was half Egyptian. And then you've got Anaxunamon, who was reincarnated, but not really, like, you know, as he says, physically, but not spiritually. So he's got to rejoin the spirit with the body, which is what he was trying to do in the first movie all along, which he does in this movie. I mean, like, the entire first movie is just like the first act of this movie. So they bring back, they resuscitate Imhotep, and then they put the soul of Anaxunamon in Patricia Velasquez, and then they go do other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are some references that they at least mercifully do some shorthand for, like, how's he going to get all of his flesh back? Okay, let's just do that in like one scene.
So, yeah, the thing with the box from the first one, we'll hire some other guys to go get the box, and then we'll trick him into opening it, and then that means he can eat them.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more economical than having to invent another method or to witness him slowly kill people for another, what was it, 45 minutes in the first movie. It was just him like lurching around killing people off screen. So it's a little more direct this time that we can move past that.
Yeah, he hired three sassy British guys instead of three dumb Americans this time to eat.
Yeah. And then, well, he didn't hire them in the first movie. But then there's the whole thing with the curator who, in the first movie, there was a good curator. In this movie, does the twist, because there's a bad curator. And he...
You mean the fellow who works at the place that has a sign on the outside that says British Museum?
Yes.
Like, they couldn't come up with a fake name other than just British Museum?
That's actually, there is a British Museum.
Okay. I'm sure there's lots of British museums.
No, but I mean, like, there is one in, I was in the one that's in London.
Is it just full of Egyptian stuff?
No, it's got lots of different things, but there is some Egyptian stuff there. Basically, anywhere they could just, like, rob and take things back to London, they did.
Mm. So. Well, this one just has, you know, halls and halls of mummies that come back to life because they overheard the reading of the fancy incantation out of the metal book from the first movie.
Yeah. And Imhotep's encased in dinosaur amber for some reason.
Yeah. Apparently when he fell into that black bubbly CG goop in the first movie, it encased him in dinosaur amber.
Yeah. So I mean they could have just drilled in and got the DNA and then right. You know, just use some amphibian DNA to fill in the missing sequences.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe
you
some
know,
cuttlefish.
Yeah, just make them all women though, so that way you don't have any unsanctioned mating. And then you have all the embryos and you put them in your little shaving cream.
Yeah, I mean, if they gave him some of the cuttlefish DNA, then he could camouflage and sneak up on the Scorpion King, and then he would have won that fight.
Yeah, but Anubis would have sprayed a black noise mat over him again and taken away his cuttlefish DNA.
Well, that was so bad. The other thing I don't get in this is that at the end of the first movie, he lost his soul, so he became mortal again, and that's how they killed him. But I guess, like, These fancy metal books just have, like, you know, the undo codes for everything in Egyptian lore, because they're like, no, we'll just read some stuff, and then he'll be fancy god guy again with all his special powers and more powers that we didn't see in the first movie.
Yeah, well, you gotta one up it, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's got levitation in this one.
Yeah, well, he levitates some things, doesn't levitate other things. That's important. He also does the water thing instead of the sand thing. That's a twist. That way you don't see the same thing again.
you don't see anything good either.
No.
That water was...
That water's not good. For people who maybe haven't seen this movie in a very long time or have elected to skip it and just listen to this podcast because you figure, oh, I'm probably not going to go see it. Well, allow us to illustrate this, to paint this with words. And we'll use as many words as there are control surfaces that created the face that is in this water, because it is unpleasant looking. This was back when, well, fluid sims even today are not like super easy, but this was back when you had a limited amount of control over certain stuff. So you could basically like smush like a mesh into another mesh, and then like that would deform the thing, and then like you could use that to drive some other stuff, and then it would basically make like a surface that sort of moved like water, and there'd be like displacement over it that was sort of like waves. Anyway, it's so low resolution in the final level of detail that you see on screen that you're just like looking at these giant flat surfaces that are his nose and his teeth, and the inside of his mouth is just like one blob. It is unfortunate that they elected to go that route, because it in no way holds up even the slightest, tiniest little level of scrutiny. And it's not like one shot. It goes on for quite some time. Yeah. In several shots.
And it also doesn't help that they basically, I don't know where they shot the plate for that canyon, but they kind of just like reprojected it onto some geometry and shot it from like four different angles and rephotographed it. And it kind of looks the same, except like super low res in some shots and like the wrong angle and perspective compared to the actual camera.
Yeah, I don't even know if they projected it, because there were a couple of shots where they're like they sort of like dolly in, but the background is sort of doing like a weird dolly zoom sort of effect, and it's
possible that they just actually like textured an object and then just got way too close to it.
I think they just tracked in some photos or something, because it's just weird. it shouldn't move the way that it moves. Especially not in relationship to the footage that they shot on their little dirigible thing. It's a mess. And even in the night shots where it's just like starry sky. Oh wow! I mean, there is one shot where they dolly in, and it's like such a bumpy dolly that you're just watching everything on the ship go up and down because the camera's going up and down, but the background is staying perfectly still, and you're just like, oh,
it's really far away, so it doesn't nobody will notice.
It's unpleasant. They maybe should have just stabilized the plate.
Yeah, right around the water in the canyon towards the end, and then to the end of the movie, it seems like a lot of people just kind of said F it and, you know, well, pushed through.
I have to think that some part of this is just that the scope of the effects that were required was greater than the time that they had to do the effects.
Probably.
Because there is also a lot of ambitious stuff where they weren't doing a lot of CG characters for a ton of things. I mean, this is back in Jar Jar Binks' time.
Little pygmy guys weren't too bad.
They
weren't great, but no. Compared to like the palm trees getting sucked into the pyramid and the canyon and
yeah, the whatever they did to instance all that jungle stuff, it was weird. And they also like CC'd it all like really super primary green in a very bizarre way, because they combined it with the set photography, which is all sort of like golden and amber and whatever. And then they gave it like also a sort of a desaturated bluish gray sky. And so you have like this like sapphire. This emerald green foliage that's just flying in. And it doesn't really seem like it's photorealistic in any way.
No, it's a super lush oasis though in the middle of the desert, which doesn't obey the laws of like light fall off from a distance.
There's a lot of stuff in here where I'm just like, where are the shadows? I don't like, especially you know, in that pyramid at the end when they have the cavern of weird flailing bodies.
Mm-hmm. The crevice of souls or whatever.
Yeah, it's very similar to what you see in hell in the Spawn movie. it's just these flailing torsos and arms. And they don't seem to have shadows, but they have a sort of Fresnel highlight that goes all the way around them. And when they interact with Imhotep's body as he falls down into the crevice, it's especially obvious because they're just sort of like grabbing around him and they're all sort of glowy edged and weird. It's bizarre.
Yeah, for a really old undead sort of immortal being who is hell-bent on ruling the world, once he gets a little bit of heartbreak, he gives up pretty easy.
Well, we were specifically talking about that end scene.
Yeah.
Wow. That really also has the added bonus of him basically just sitting still, just slightly below the surface level with his arms like totally still, like not struggling or anything. He's just like, oh, help me get up. And it's just like, you're not really. I think this is a situation where you could help yourself just like a smidge. But
maybe he was just evenly matched with the glowy ghost people, and like, you know, they were holding him down and he was trying to pull himself up, but they were just perfectly evenly matched and he couldn't go anywhere.
Yeah, except he wasn't really being pulled on by any external force. He just kind of sat there. But and he gave up and goes down into the soul land and stuff. But
did he die? Because he lost his soul and died in the first movie.
Death is very fluid in these. much like
death
the Sims.
Only the beginning.
Yeah. No, but this it's weird. I have to say, maybe the worst death is Anaximandre's death. Where Patricia Velasquez is walking out of the temple, and then all of a sudden she goes, whoa, and falls into the black mat full of weird bubbly noise stuff. Yeah. And it's just like, are these bugs? What's happening here?
Because I think they were supposed to be scarabs, but they like color corrected it. And then they're like, well, it's way too dark now. Do we go back to CG and have them re-render this so it's not so dark? And like, eh. I mean, we'll just put the scarab sounds in and people will get the idea.
It's very strange. And like, as she sort of dissolves away, it's basically like a mat dissolves her away. It's not,
they just kind of drew some shapes around her.
Yeah, you don't feel like there are bugs crawling over her at any point. It's unfortunate. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah. And then, you know, the end of this movie, it's very much like a Star Wars prequel, in that it does like a whole bunch of different things all at the same time, and none of them are particularly interesting or helpful. Like, they finally get there, and then, you know, they're in a hurry because you got the ticking clock of the kid with the thing on his wrist, and he's got to get inside the pyramid before the sun hits it, or else he'll die, which they do. And then they're like, yay, we did it. And then Anaximandre just like walks up behind Evelyn and stabs her. They're like, well, she's dead. Okay, we got to keep going though. So Rick's going to get all mad and then like chase him in there. And then, you know, the kid will be smart because he's smart. So he'll go get the book and then he'll revive her. And then she'll like remember that she's Nefertiti, and she'll go fight Anaximandre in a very similar to battle to the way they did it in the flashback with the little pokey things. I forget what those are called.
Size.
The Raphael Ninja Turtle stuff.
See, and I was more of a Donatello fan. So.
For sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Are you a Donatello fan?
I was a big Donatello fan, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But see, in the flashback, Anaximandre was the one who went and got the spear stick.
Yes.
So does that mean we're team Anaximandre, even though she's too dumb to like not fall in a river of scarabs?
Fall in a river of mats? No. I'm going to say that maybe perhaps Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and The Mummy Returns don't have that shared history, quite like Star Wars and The Mummy Returns have a shared history. Because I mean, this was, you know, around the time of Attack of the Clones. You know, yeah. more desert planets.
Yeah, desert. The desert stuff was fine, except.
What was your favorite thing about the Egyptian Braveheart fight thing?
My favorite part was the large round solid that they made with animated scarab edges that sort of just moved over the land in no particular way that would like track properly, and then just sort of like disappeared off the edge of the frame, and then the sand was black, which is where the army of Anubis came from. And then, you know, for like talking about how they're so worried that the army of Anubis will rise and then destroy the whole world, and then whoever controls them will be able to rule the whole world. They did a pretty good job of dispatching most of them. I mean, at least the first wave.
Yeah, they seem far less threatening than the mummy guards, and they are not especially durable. Like, there are a couple of them where Oded like hits it in the stomach and then like punches it in the face with the hilt of the thing, or like stabs it once, and then it's just like poof, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like vampire explosion of dust. It's really unfortunate. They just don't really seem super threatening at all, that the Magi were able to dispatch them. But it also, the whole entire time you're watching it, you're like, why are the Magi doing this? Because this seems ridiculously stupid. Because they just don't really seem like they'd be evenly matched for a supernatural army.
Well, I guess if they don't, like, stand in the way, the army is just going to, like, keep running until it gets to civilization and then kill all the other people? I don't know.
Well, it's going to do that anyway.
They can slow them down, then.
Well, they do. And they have some slow motion. There's that one really weird shot with Oded when he runs across where all the other people are.
When he runs through the people and they do that sort of like through the trees shot that they repeat like four times to make it look like he's running through an extra large crowd of people.
Yeah, there is some weird editing in this movie. So he gets to the other side after that peculiar speed ramp, and he sees the wave of more of them coming over the dunes, galloping from further away, because presumably the Scarab Matt deposited them on the other side of the hill. couldn't just put them all in the one spot. So it's really very strange. I don't understand it from like a dramatic tension perspective. I get the feeling that like they wanted to have the escalating tension of a battle, and then like it looks like they won, but they didn't really. And then it needs to come down to them getting saved by the actual thing that's happening inside the temple. But there are so many things happening in this movie that it's almost just complete filler. It's not dramatic.
No, none of it is. It's all mostly filler. I have a question though. So I thought whoever defeats the Scorpion King got control over the army. Was that not the case?
Yes, but see, then
they all just disappeared.
No, but see, Brendan Fraser says, "Go back to HE double hockey sticks and take all of your friends with you." And so that's why he dies. And then there's the implosion of everything and the army turns to dust. And then the forest gets sucked up with all the pygmy zombies. I don't know if that's a politically correct term for short zombies of this peculiar nature
in the movie.
Yeah, it's very strange. I don't understand what sparked that. It just seems like the only motivation was that he wanted to have that shot from The Lost World where they're looking at the cornfield and everything's rustling underneath. And so he wanted to do that with just like little shrubs rustling.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's very strange. But they're in there for some reason.
So there's not like an official induction ceremony where he has to like put on a thing like a bracelet or a hat or something that lets him control the army. It's just like, as soon as you poke the Scorpion King with the spear, you can tell him what to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's just what they said in the thing. And then they had the helpful drawings about how to kill him in his house.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Yeah.
It was a good place to put him.
It's not even like it was hieroglyphics. It was just like panel one, panel two, panel three.
It was like
three.
IKEA instructions.
Exactly.
It was like IKEA little instructions how to kill Scorpion King.
Those little sideways guys that helps you put together your coffee table were showing you how to extend the spear and then throw it into the Scorpion King.
Yeah. I mean, the spear was really, the spear of Osiris is really like the Allen wrench of Osiris, if you think about it.
Yeah. And then, you know, pulling the old, like, no, I'm on your side, but he came to kill you, and then I'm just going to, like, let you guys fight and then sneak up on you later. And
it was not terribly clear to me what the point of that deception was, because he sneaks off into that room in the back, but I guess just to hide there?
Yeah, I think he was waiting until everybody gets tired out.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really seem like, I mean, maybe there was part of this that got cut out or something where it was like, oh, there's a secret thingy back there for something. I don't know, but it's not there. It just seems strange.
I was just going to go get an Egyptian Gatorade and refresh a little bit.
Oh, he's probably parched from all the zombieing and mummying mm-hmm. and stuff. Mm-hmm. Now his the curator guy who put his arm in the thing and pulled it out and it was all dissolved. He comes wandering in and he's all like, what's going on here? It's almost like there's a Scorpion King, which I was the plan all along. And I'm totally surprised by this. And then he's like, Imhotep, save me. And he's like, why? And then the priest guy is like, oh, no. And then the Scorpion King pulls him apart with two claws, which causes the curator to fly apart into five pieces.
Yeah, well, he might have used some of his like tiny little legs. But yeah, he gets he carries him up to the ceiling and he Mortal Kombat finishes him.
Well, Scorpion, Mortal Kombat, got to do it.
Also, he's kind of like a little bit of Goro, the forearm dude.
Yeah, yeah. Bad effects, big guy. Makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Similar hair.
I don't know if you noticed this, but the hair had those little, like, I don't know, clasps or clips or whatever, the little gold things that were, like, halfway down and then the little ponytails that were hanging on the side. And if you look at the close-up shots, whenever he turns his head and then the hair moves, those little things are jiggling around like crazy because they're like bouncing around from the dynamic tension of being driven by the hair sim. So I just kept staring at those when I wasn't staring at the weird plastic Flex Armstrong expression that The Rock had on his face.
It seems like the majority of the expressions on his face were not animated. They were just sort of like spline warped because, you know, like he moves his like cheekbones a little bit and his eyebrows a little bit, but he never like opens his mouth. So it's like all the stuff that you could do with like a 2D distortion. It's like they just to save time like rendered him with a single facial expression and they're like, yeah, we'll just warp it in 2D to make it look like he's, you know, making faces and stuff.
No, I mean, I think they just posed it according to like reference things or whatever and then just like left it there because he didn't have any dialogue.
Why didn't he open his mouth?
Well, I mean, he talks to when what's his face is all like, oh, no, I'm your servant. And he's like, we shall see or whatever. Like he talks there and he opens his mouth.
I don't know, man. It just looked like he was like half smiling the whole time.
Well, I think it's just not really good work. I don't really think it was 2D is what I'm saying.
Mm.
I just didn't have enough things driving the face movement for the stuff.
Yeah. They should have done that UV unwrap animation rewrap thing that I showed you.
I don't even remember that.
I sent you the videos from the third one of these movies.
Oh yeah, from when Rhythm and Hughes got the contract to do the Dragon Emperor.
I thought it was a Digital Domain in that video, at least.
Yeah, might have been both of them.
Yeah, who knows? It was an NAB demo from a zillion years ago.
Yeah, I know Rhythm worked on part of it, so maybe they split it. But this one's all ILM. not on their A game.
I mean, the movie made a lot of money somehow.
Yeah. And it not just made a lot of money, but it had a direct sequel, and it also had the whole spin-off of Scorpion King movies.
How many of those were there? There wasn't more than one of those, was there?
Oh, yeah. But I think they were all direct to video.
Those did not seem like a good idea.
No.
I mean, but you know, the Dwayne was good. He was getting into the acting. Was this his first gig, really? Like his first major gig?
I think this is his first film role.
He played a mugger in Long Shot, but I don't think that's a. Oh no, that was after this. Mm-hmm. Scorpion King. Yeah, this was. He was in a couple TV movies, but this looks like his first feature.
Yeah. Now, and I think he was on Star Trek Voyager before this.
Who cares?
It was a really bad episode.
There you go. The champion, Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah. Tsunkatsi. Anyway, we're not going to go back into that again.
I hope you're looking at IMDb and you didn't just remember that off the top of your head.
I remembered off the top of my head.
Oh, my God.
It's well, I mean, I had put in that clip from that episode when we did the rundown. So, of course, I remember.
Right. That's
I'm not,
right.
I'm not going to do that again because I feel like the rundown deserved it and this movie does not. This movie does not deserve the Johnson love.
Let's see. The Scorpion King, Scorpion King, Rise of Acadian. There's the rundown. I'm scrolling. Was he not in
I like that you narrated that you're scrolling.
It was Doom. It was he was in a Hannah Montana episode.
Good for him. How many years after this was the Tooth Fairy?
The Tooth Fairy was 2010. So, you know, yeah. What is after?
Nine years. Yeah.
9 years. Wait, what was his first lead? I guess Scorpion King, wasn't it? So only 1 year later.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it was like a bundled deal. Like he filmed this and did that other thing before this came out. And so he wasn't like, oh, that's a terrible Scorpion person that you put in this film.
I think they just, you know, they took the little prelude in this movie and decided to farm some more false mythology out of it. And they're like, wow, we didn't beat the myth of the Scorpion King quite to death. And he seemed like a cool character. So let's just do a whole bunch more of that.
See, the problem is he seemed like a cool character in the flashback at the beginning for those like 2 minutes.
Except the part where they're like, and he was defeated and sadly slowly walked home for hundreds of miles. And then like, it's like, okay, I know in the previous scene we were just walking and looking very stern. In this one, we're going to be walking and sort of stumbling as if we're tired or drunk. And go, everybody. So everyone just looked like they were pretending to be real tired.
Yeah, well, you know, they're just pretending to be... it's like when the Dothraki are defeated, and then they're like wandering around, and Daenerys Targaryen is the Khaleesi, and, you know, they gotta wander from place to place.
It's totally just like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know.
It's a Game of Thrones thing. At least I heard. I recognized a couple of the words.
Yes. Words.
Did you say Dothraki?
Dothraki.
Dothraki.
Yeah. But if The Rock was in it, they'd be the Dothraki. Ha-ha!
Sure.
Nothing? Nothing? Yeah. Okay.
Somebody's got to discourage you from such things.
I feel like I discourage myself, but that one was special. It needed to be said. So the thing is, we basically just trashed the end of this film, because I think that's the part that we can all agree is horrible. Yeah. But was there anything that we want to salvage from the beginning that we didn't talk about, or anything in the ponderous middle of this film?
You know, after you get your little parable there, you get introduced very slowly and dramatically to Brendan Fraser sort of meandering around a temple with his little, you know, torch and then gun out, and he's surprised, but oh, it turns out to be his kid, because he has a kid now, and it's British. And then, you know, Evelyn's down there using a paintbrush to look at some hieroglyphics, and then they knock the thing in, and then they go find the box with the Scorpion King's little bracelet in it and stuff. And then it turns into a Universal Studios ride where all the water comes flooding in, and they got to escape real fast. But, you know, the family dynamic stuff is probably the strongest in the movie. They feel like a believable family, and the relationship feels real. But everything else in this movie is just really stupid. I mean, you know, basically right up until when they get back home in England, and then Jonathan's there like traipsing around their gigantic mansion for some reason. They have a massive house. He's traipsing around pretending to be rich and like hitting on some lady whose stockings are on a bookshelf, but like she's still like dressed when it's not entirely clear what Jonathan has been doing in their house. He's just walking around with a gold scepter, hitting on some lady in a house that's not his. And then, you know, the bad curator guys in the red robes show up, and then there's the fight and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He gets his asp kicked.
There's a lot of cartoon character violence. You know, you got the guy with the sword, what was the one guy's name who kept, who was basically just playing off the kid the whole time, and I can't wait to kill Lochnaw. Is that the character?
Yeah, Lochnaw.
Can't wait to cut your hand off and take that thing from you, because I'm, you know,
I can't wait to murder children.
Yeah, I only got to tolerate you as long as the mummy guy says so, but I can't wait to kill you and take that thing, and I'm totally going to do it. And
in all fairness to Lochnaw, Alex is really annoying.
Just walk away. Walk away.
Yeah.
You don't have to bring him water. You don't have to listen to his crap. You don't have to listen to the, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Just walk away.
Yeah. But I think if you're traveling in this group, that you might have some personality disorder issues or something that might lead you to believe that maybe killing this kid would be the best recourse.
Yeah, speaking of her crew, it's sort of run by curator guy slash reincarnated in Oxunamon, who, again, as he says later, you're not really her, you just look like her. But she was apparently reincarnated with the knowledge of where he was buried after the end of the first movie, but she didn't, like, know or use that knowledge until she was, you know, what, like in her 30s or something? And then you've got this other thing where Evelyn is having these dreams where she can, like, see stuff. Like, she's having flashbacks to her previous life as Nefertiti, but that's probably because it coincides with the year of the Scorpion, which doesn't make sense because her flashbacks have nothing to do with the Scorpion King. Her flashbacks are just, you know, the Pharaoh and Imhotep and the murdering and stuff.
Well, only for some contrived reason, after that little fight that they have in front of the Pharaoh, he says, oh, that's why you're in charge of guarding the bracelet of Anubis.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, and then he says, my daughter, and it's like, oh, this is so creepy. Like, it's your daughter, and then you're marrying basically somebody who's her age.
Yeah, and
not to be judgmental about that sort of thing, but having them fight in front of you like that for your affection, wearing barely any clothes, is a little strange.
You know, I was, because I didn't remember that she was supposed to be the Pharaoh's daughter until he said that. When I was watching him fight, and then he goes like, ah, my future wife is like, was the winner of this fight, like, supposed to be your wife? Like, is this how you pick the wife? But then, like, it goes immediately to the next scene where he's all, you know, from the first movie where he's super protective and, like, nobody's allowed to touch her. And it's like, wait, did you institute that, like, 4 hours ago and you're already super pissed that somebody, like, touched her shoulder? Or was she going to be your wife all along? And then you just thought it would be fun to see your fiance fight your daughter.
It's very strange.
And then you get the weird editing of, like, Imhotep standing there, and he looks very concerned that, like, an Oxunamon's going to get, like, hurt or stabbed or something. And then, like, they cut back to him after an Oxunamon does something, like, fancy, and he's, like, smiling, like, yeah, good job, man. It's like, wait, what? Stop going from, like, worried about her safety to, like, smiling, like, yeah, kick the Pharaoh's daughter's ass.
Well, it's also weird because he remembers her so clearly. And doesn't remember the Pharaoh's daughter at all because he was going to kill her in the first movie, or at least somebody who looked very much like the Pharaoh's daughter, and makes no comment of it. And then in this film,
maybe it's because in the first movie he got, like, mad at her before he really had eyeballs, and then, like, once he first saw her, like, there was just different context or something.
He was so mad he couldn't see straight. All the stuff where they tried to, like, as we said, like, the first thing when we were talking about this, all the stuff where they tried to retroactively add all of this rich expository backstory to this, where there's destiny and prophecy and always meant to be crap that was glued on that wasn't there in the first place, even on top of things that were glued on, even on top of things that were in the first movie. I think that this is definitely the part where it's just, like, so convoluted. Like, they didn't really need to be, like, destined enemies and, like, fighting for the Pharaoh's effect. Like, it really has no bearing on the Scorpion King component of this, other than, hey, you get to guard my cool gold bracelet now. It doesn't really, like, have anything to do with anything, really. And as for her reincarnated Anoxenamun stuff, that is also weird, like you're saying, and it's not explained, but I took that to mean that she was having at least some inklings of the same sorts of flashbacks and memories and stuff that Rachel Weisz's character was having, because Rachel Weisz suddenly knows how to fight people that she didn't know how to fight before. She's suddenly remembering the layout of a chamber that she shouldn't know, but knows all the tricks to. So it's not like she knows, but has like a sort of subconscious knowledge. And that seems to also be at play with Anaxenamun to some degree, is my theoretical headcanon for that, because it doesn't make a whole ton of sense. It also doesn't really make any sense how she linked up with the evil curator to know that they would do this, and then he would have his mercenary army of servants who would be totally cool with all this murdering and stuff, and traveling back and forth between Egypt and London, no questions asked, and renting a special train with your special murder car in the back. It's all very weird.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. Literally all of that. I mean, yeah, the only thing one could assume is that she was having the same flashbacks because you're the Scorpion or whatever, but I still don't know why that has anything to do with anything.
Nobody will never know, because it wasn't in the film.
This one I have less good feelings about with regard to, like, you know, I said I liked the, you know, the backdrop of the sort of mystical sort of ancient Egyptian stuff where, you know, there's still a lot of unknown sort of mystical stuff that you could crowbar a bunch of stories into. But this kind of just ruins all of that. And rather than building off any sort of like actual thing that might be believable, they're just building off of the first movie, which is not great place to start.
Are you saying it's not a solid foundation?
It's not a particularly solid foundation, no.
No. Well, at the beginning of the film, they try to give them some of that Indiana Jones flavor.
Well, they even gave them the hat, too.
Yes. And they just, if they had gone more that route and less the loopy predestination nonsense, mumbo-jumbo stuff, then maybe it would have been more charming. Much in the same way that the first film was more charming, because there's the dirigible pilot guy who I find incredibly annoying, and I find the dirigible thing so gimmicky and ridiculous that it doesn't really need to be in here with the rockets and everything. Like compare that to our Royal Air Force guy from Wilson or whatever his name was from the first one.
Well, I mean, that guy had a much smaller piece to the story, and I guess in this one they just wanted a comic relief character that spent a little bit more time with the main characters. And also, you know, of course, there's that unspoken backstory, because, you know, as soon as he sees him, he goes, and runs away, and he's like, oh, yeah, he totally remembers you, because there's totally a backstory here that we don't need to explain, right, guys?
Well, they do explain it. They say that it was a bank job and it's not what it sounds like. And then he shot me in the butt. So, you know, that's that. But the part that I mean that's ridiculous is that he's sort of cartoonish, and the airship that they take is cartoonish, and not in the, this is a retired plane of some sort. This is a completely made up airship with rocket engines. So it's just really it doesn't need to be in there, and doesn't really like evoke the sort of like swashbuckling, you know, Errol Flynn kind of stuff, or the, you know, Indiana Jones kind of stuff. Like it's just odd. And you have the whole thing with Oded and the Falcon.
Horus.
Yeah, Horus the Falcon. And it's just like, why is this here? Did they sell Horus the Falcon toys? What happened?
I think they thought it would be adorable. He said it was, what does he say, it was like his best and most loyal friend or something.
Yeah, whatever. Sorry. I don't mean that as commentary on people who think that they have best and most loyal friends. I just mean that about this bird. So
the bird should it should have flown a little higher.
So silly.
Poor guy.
Yeah. So I mean, and that largely leads to the middle part of this movie feeling flabby and ludicrous, because it's
flabby and ludicrous.
It's mostly Oded and his weird conversations and the flashbacks to the stuff that doesn't make any sense from back in ancient Egypt, and the airship, which is terrible, with the aforementioned bad keys and stuff for that in the match move.
I mean, the scene in the double-decker bus cruising around London was a thing that was memorable. When that came on, I was like, oh yeah, they did that thing with the mummies that run on the walls and stuff, and it was a big goofy set piece and mummies.
That's more the beginning of the film ish before they get to the middle. But
it's memorable.
What's also memorable is they said, hey, remember that shot of the mummy guards who do that roaring thing where their mouths open really wide?
Yeah, did they actually reuse the footage from the other movie?
No, they didn't. But it looks very similar.
I mean, it looks like they reused the render and comped it over a different background, I should say.
No, they didn't do that. It looks more detailed, but only barely. It just looks like it was designed to be exactly the same.
Yeah, it's really a good thing that somebody scooped them up in that big pot after the first movie so he could carry them around.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. It's not how they worked in the first film. But anyway, he opens it up and they all pop out and then he commands them, which isn't really something that they did in the first one either. But whatever. They go storming off after him. And it doesn't make any sense. If they could turn to dust, then why would blowing them up hinder them, really?
Well, that one got flattened Wile E. Coyote style on the wall there.
Yeah, it was a very Joe Dante shot. There was the whole thing with the, like, nail claws. It was like, that was
new.
It was like, and why did we need to do it?
Well, because he wants to, like, mess him up.
No, but why, like, in a, I'm the director and writer of this film, why did I do this?
Well, I mean, it was scary. But, like, they didn't use it at any point to, like, harm anyone. He, like, kind of grazes Oded briefly, but, like, why don't they have those out all the time?
It doesn't, because it was some idea that he had later on. Because he can't kill Oded as fast as he would ordinarily kill people, because Oded needs to be around for the rest of the film, so he has to do something that might be threatening, but not immediately kill him, which means slashing at him.
Yeah, he gets sliced in the shoulder, like, a couple times.
Yeah, so he gets the shoulder nicks from the nails, and they do that a couple times, and then right before he's gonna kill Oded, right before he's gonna get him, right before Oded's dead, he does the shouty screamy thing, and then Rachel Weisz blows his head off. So, you know, pause for dramatic effect, death. It's silly.
That's how it always goes.
Yeah, that's how it works.
That's why the entire empire fell, you know, thousands of years ago, is because they would always pause for dramatic effect, and then, you know, somebody who was just more efficient would just sneak up and kill him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, as long as your hero is off screen, then you can do whatever you want.
Speaking of off screen, mm-hmm. My favorite way that they saved a bunch of money in this movie was when the kid was bringing back his mom by reading from the book. And it was just a close-up on his face, and he was reading an incantation, and then, like, some flickery caustics came up on his face, and he just made, like, an open-mouth stare, and then, you know, cut to she's alive.
Yeah.
Saved a lot of money on trying to do any sort of, like, effect to bring her back.
Well, I don't want to criticize them, because I don't think whatever effect they could have done would have necessarily been that great, because they seem overextended.
Sure. It was a very practical decision. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know,
it's the sort of decision that they could have made elsewhere in this film as well, and didn't.
I mean, it's just the hinging it on the kid's little amazed expression and some glowy blue lights didn't really do it for me.
Oh, sorry, that was underwhelming.
Yeah. Also, the fact that, like, once she got stabbed and then quickly died, there was no blood or anything really.
No, that would be horrifying. This is a movie that children could go see. Dan. Yeah,
it would be traumatic for the child who was standing right there too.
Yeah, you just need to have mothers get murdered in front of their children. As long as there's no blood, it's totes fine.
And then I liked how, like, you know, not like 2 minutes later, her brother is like, "Look at it this way." And it was like trying to rationalize with the kid, like, "It's not so bad that your mom's dead." And it's like, why are you doing that? Don't do that.
Yeah, well, he says that because he needs to say the good book, which gives the kid the idea, oh, the book.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Boy.
And then, what's this thing? This is a symbol. I don't know what it is. It looks like, and he does the arm flappy thing that John Hannah did in the first movie. It looks it's like a bird.
It's a reference to the other one.
Yeah.
Manifest. Not find it charming at all.
Yeah.
It was basically just obnoxious.
Yep. Really annoying.
It's a thing where they basically just made, they did the first movie again inside the second movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's called it's a callback.
Sure.
A reference.
Not even so much a reference, though. They were just literally doing the same stuff.
No, I mean, they are referencing the events of the first film. Like, it's a comedy beat, because you remember how it unfolded the first time, where Jonathan was the one who was asking, and now Jonathan's the one who has to answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He learned. He grew as a character from the first movie to the second one.
Yeah, that is his arc. He learned one hieroglyph in the course of one film. One and a half films, I guess. And it's just, this is just a weird movie that we talked about in under an hour.
Yeah.
Basically all of the important things we covered.
I mean, it's another one of those ones where there are the large action-y fight bits, but not a ton happens for the majority of it. Then like all of it is crammed into the end. So what, like they find the bracelet, they take the bracelet home, the bad guys are digging up the mummy guy. Did you bring the bracelet? No, we didn't get the bracelet. They got the bracelet. All right, let's go get the bracelet. We go to London, we get the bracelet, and then we also kidnap what's her name, and then we bring back the mummy, you know, just do what we were going to do in the first movie, but all in like the first 25 minutes or something. And then we go find the stuff. I forgot how long it was, but it was infuriating when they did the bracelet montage, where apparently the bracelet doesn't show you like the full map. It only shows you like the turn by turn directions to Egypt. So it's like, go to Karnak. And then when you get to Karnak, open up your Scorpion King maps app again, and then it'll show you where the next route is. But they did it so many times where he's like making little really, really accurate sandcastles with just like a little bit of water and some sand, and then covering it up with a piece of his clothing for his parents to find. It's like, it's a good thing there weren't more stops on his trip, because like he would be naked by the time he got to the Scorpion King thing.
It was a strange choice too, because it doesn't really seem like a good mapping solution. And also, like, why would you have if you start to think about the mechanics of it, it's just like, so there's a bracelet which is not with the Scorpion King, but that somebody can find that will lead them to the Scorpion King so that they can bring him back, or they die on their way there and then somebody else can get the bracelet.
And then I thought they were going to have to like put the bracelet on to command the army.
Yeah, and then the bracelet has nothing to do with that. It just boots the Scorpion King up. And then once he's booted up, he controls the army, but you must kill him to control the army, but if you don't, then you're also like destroying the entire planet. So it doesn't really seem like there's a good incentive to follow these directions that you're being given in this really terrible way.
Aside from the fact that it's going to like quote unquote kill you.
Yeah, I mean, you think about something like the map rune scene in Indiana Jones, and you think about this and you're just like, well, that's not really great. It seems like you just did something flashy. It doesn't mm-hmm. it doesn't like communicate anything important, and it doesn't give you that sort of like mystical sense of awe, because you're just watching aerial footage that's flashing by really fast.
Yeah. He forgot to read the terms and conditions on his Scorpion King Maps app, and basically it said, like, look, you can use this to get you to the place, but if you don't get there fast enough, it's going to kill you. Can't be helped. It's just the way it goes. And then when you get there, then you put it in the thing, and it's going to eat your arm.
Yeah, well, that's why you got to be careful with the iTunes EULA.
Yeah, you know? I mean, what are you going to do? Like, are you going to just not accept it? Like, you got to accept it and take the risk, though.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, the odds are pretty good nothing bad's going to happen to you. You know, it's
just going to a temple of somebody called the Scorpion King.
Yeah. Or die. And so, I don't know, everything about the mechanics of how that functioned just seem ridiculous, because it throws you out of the movie when you start thinking about why any of it is happening at all. Because it's just like, it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, there's
you
also
need to
the
have
part
it
where
to drive the plot forward. And so that's why it's in there. It's just absurd.
It's completely, but like the right up into the part where he gets to the temple in time and it saves him, and it like since he beat the timer, the sands of time or whatever, it pops off his wrist and he's like, cool, you're safe now. But like, why did it pop off his wrist if it has to be on your wrist to be inserted into the wall thing to open the door, mm-hmm. and also eat your arm off? So it's like, you did the thing you were supposed to do, but also you did a bad thing because it ate your arm, but also it did a good thing because it opened the door. Like, what is this? It's like that one guy. I appreciate that at least that one guy when they were in the train car said that, you know, this place is cursed, and they made fun of him saying, you keep saying this room is cursed and that room is cursed and everything is cursed. And it's like, well, yeah, that's what I was thinking too. But at least he was kind of right. Like, everything's cursed and you're all going to die.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's also the line where Evie's recounting the story of the mythological Scorpion King, where there's no evidence that remains, so how is there a myth? But anyway, she's recounting that, and then it's like, oh, and then let me guess, all the people went there, died. And she's like, oh, you heard of this story? And he's like, no, it's just how these stories go. Because this kind of movie, it's just how these movies go. Just like, it's just stuff just keeps happening. People keep dying. There are big celestial reasons for things and stuff that have absolutely nothing to do with how human beings would think, supposedly. Mm-hmm.
And let me guess, the army's going to destroy the world. Yeah, how do you know? Well, it's just how it always goes.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of appropriate mocking.
Well, and then another piece of dramatic flair that doesn't really make a ton of sense either is when Imhotep has the kid and he takes out his big dramatic hourglass. It's not an hourglass. I guess a day glass.
It's a week glass. It's got like 5 days left on it.
That's the weird part. Is like, it's not even a full week. It's like, here's my 5 day counter glass that I have that will precisely count down until your death. Wahahaha! It's like, why do you have one?
It's a work week hourglass. He's counting the hours until it's the weekend again.
They didn't have unions. They didn't have weekends.
He's just, you know. He's a big fan of like TGI Friday's happy hour and going out with the crew after work on Friday afternoon.
Yeah, mummy-rella sticks.
That's kind of what he looked like in this movie. A mummy-rella stick.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's more like a crumpled up paper bag when he gets brought back. So on the one level, he has the mummy version of him has more bumpy displacement detail than he had in the previous film. But on another level, he doesn't really have like the sort of diffuse color detail that you would expect or seemingly any subsurface detail.
I don't even know what you call that displacement on his face. It was like really deep and really kind of odd. Like, I don't know, it wasn't really going for like muscle striation or anything. It was just like, I don't know, like somebody fried some oatmeal or something. I don't even know how to describe it.
It was just like Terrigen on his face. You've seen Terrigen terrain generator stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, it's just like fractal canyons and stuff just on his face.
Turned up a little bit too high.
It was way too deep. Also, there's this one shot that I looked at. I can't even remember what it was, but he basically like leans in to talk to somebody on one side of the screen. And as he's leaning in, there's this one white pixel that's flashing in the back as something's popping over the displacement. And we're just like, oh, that's so charming.
I missed that one. You should make a GIF out of that.
No, I most certainly won't. But it, you know, you just turn up the shading rate a little and you're PR man.
Mm.
Yeah.
Shading rate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is.
Don't need to. That's the good thing about everybody moving to ray traced, physically accurate lighting stuff is that you don't need to know any of these arcane gobbledygook words that you have to know for the old school Render Man stuff.
I felt like maybe I'm misremembering, but did the Scorpion King's hair also have a little bit of that, like, weren't enough samples in it? Sort of moray nonsense going on in there.
It seemed like there weren't a ton of hair strands in it, and I'm not sure how they shaded it exactly, but typically what happens is there's a curve that's there and it's driven by a control curve. And for that curve, it's shaded not like a surface, but sort of like a tube kind of, but it's sort of an approximation because there are so many hairs that you can't actually like put geometry everywhere for everything. And because of that cheating, you would, especially in early hair stuff, like if you watch The Incredibles or something like that, if you look at like the root of the hair, it doesn't shade like the surface that it's touching. And if you look at where the hair touches the skin, like if a character is touching their hair with their hand, the hand and the hair don't seem to shade similarly to one another. Mm. And that's because they're different lighting models.
Approximation of a tube.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing about RenderMan is like it's all approximation stuff. Like all the bounce light is physically, it's hand placed, artisanal, locally sourced bounce light. Like it doesn't come from the factory farms. You know, that you gotta have somebody in there who's gotta pop up a little light underneath to bounce up a little light into the darkened corners of his face, because there isn't gonna be any of the bounce light from the room just naturally going around. And for the audience members at home who are like, what is Joe talking about? What is bounce light? If you hold up your hand to a wall in a brightly lit room, your hand is not going to be pitch black. It's going to get light from the wall because light bounces from the light source off the wall to your hand. And most ray tracers, what they do is they trace from the hand to the wall, to the light, to the camera stuff. It depends on the ray tracing solution. But back in the RenderMan days, all you got was a light would hit the surface, and it would even hit the surface on the other underside of the hand and everything, because it would only shade based on normals. And then you got the shadow maps, where there's basically a rendered depth map of distance from the light source that measures out certain areas and figures out where you can occlude. And so that's what generated shadows and things for a long time. And that's why a lot of the times older RenderMan things can look a little glowy, because they don't have like really crisp shadows. Or if they have shadows that are blurry, they'll be blurry all over and not like blurry like real life, where things get blurrier as they get further away from an object. So anyway, I'm not going to make Dan cry by continuing to talk about this.
No, I think I understood most of that. That was interesting.
Yeah, it's just it's all this stuff where back in the day you'd have to contend with this absurdity. And you can see many of these shortcomings on display in this film because they are doing so many things and doing so much stuff. And it seems like they had to render things so quickly that it doesn't feel like they had a lot of time to finesse. Like where the shadows were, or the density of the shadows, or the shadow blur, or anything like that. So you see a lot of that here.
Was anything good going on around 2001? Like, I mean, this isn't the high watermark for the year, is it?
I don't actually think I know exactly what happened in 2001, other than our trip to the moons of Jupiter and the monolith. But
did you say Attack of the Clones?
I think that was 2002.
Sounds right.
Technically,
I'm trying to avoid typing on the internet because I have the clicky keyboard in front of me.
Oh yeah, you don't want to give away the trick.
My setup has been modified for the show. I apologize.
Yeah. So you got Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is the first Harry Potter movie. That also has that cave troll that people are not super fond of. If you remember, I don't even think it's a cave troll. It's just the troll thing that guards the thing. Anyway, people aren't fond of it. And then there's Lord of the Ring.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is the one with the Lord of the Rings with the horses made out of water? Was that around the same time or was that later?
That was also that was 2001 too. Weta did all of that stuff that's in there.
That was a better water sim than this one, wasn't it?
Well, it was also on screen for far less time. So you weren't like looking at the slow motion interior of a horse's mouth. so they had that going for them, where they didn't do that. Now, if it had been modern day Peter Jackson, there probably would have been a flying camera through the the individual teeth of the
48 frames a second, very tight shutter.
Oh man,
3D,
what a mess.
This movie should get a 3D conversion.
You know, I think they did convert the first one, but I don't know if they converted this one. I think Stereo D did it or something.
Oh, my. I bet the flying pygmy zombies looked really intimidating in 3D.
Yikes. Oh, well, you know, that's something about the first Mummy movie, too. There's a lot of stuff that flies at camera, and there's a lot of stuff in this movie that flies at camera. So it almost feels like something where they were composing for the 3D, but it was well in advance of that time. Shrek came out this year. Ocean's 11 came out this year. Pearl Harbor came out this year. Jurassic Park 3. Planet of the Apes, the Tim Burton one, the horrible Tim Burton one.
Well, that was all practical effects.
Oh, God. Remember when they were so proud of how they got the apes to run really fast on all fours? And it was because they had them run on a tarp that was basically being dragged by a car. So it looked like they were moving really fast, running on all fours.
I don't remember that at all. What do you mean a tarp?
Well, they basically were running on a surface that was being dragged. And so they were moving fast because they were being dragged, but they weren't having to run as fast as they would need to in order to actually move that fast.
And then they what? Presumably shot it at a low angle with a bunch of like foliage in the foreground?
I think it was dust.
Oh, great, dust. That's...
They were jogging over, they were running on all fours over like dusty plains or something. Anyway, that movie is just a disaster, start to finish. Hannibal was also this year. Remember the pigs?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't see Hannibal?
No, I don't think so.
I saw Hannibal, and then afterwards, I was really hungry. And I saw, this is one that I saw by myself. And so I went down to the Sbarro that's in the food court in West Shore Plaza Mall. And I went to the Sbarro and I ordered a meat stuffed pizza. Remember how they would do the pizza that was a crust that went all the way around? So it was like a big circular flat calzone that would slice into wedges like a pizza.
Right. Wasn't it basically a pizza face down on top of another pizza and then they would connect the backside? So it would just be like solid.
Yeah, I don't know how, I don't specifically understand the construction of this monstrosity, but it was just basically two slices of pizza glued together vertically. And so I was having that, and there were the pieces of Italian sausage. And I was looking at it, I was like, oh, this looks an awful lot like Ray Liotta's brain. So glad I'm thinking about that from the movie now while I'm eating this gray thing.
Brain itself feels no pain, Clarice, if that concerns you. For example, Paul won't miss this little piece here, which is the part of the prefrontal lobe, which they say is the seat of good manners.
Your profile at the border stations has 5 features. I'll trade you.
Trade?
Stop now, and I'll tell you what they
are. How does that word taste you, Clarice? Cheap and metallic, like sucking on a greasy coin?
Who's Clarice?
Agent Starling, Paul, if you can't keep up with the conversation, you better not try to join in at all.
Gray mystery meat.
Ray Liotta's brain on a pizza. Did it have pineapple to go with it?
No. This was before that. This is before that phase of my life. Before I knew any better, and I was eating at a Sbarro's.
So. Sbarro's was good for a while. I mean, it was enjoyable. It was fast. They had a nice sweet sauce that had a little bit of extra oregano pop to it. It was good. Their cheese was relatively high quality for a while.
It sort of always gave me heartburn.
I mean, it was like a Toys R Us approximation of New York style pizza.
It wasn't even like that New York-y. It was just sort of that sort of fluffy crust kind of stuff. Like, it wasn't as thin as it should be.
Right. But it was big. The big triangle slices.
It was also, you know, it was cheap and it was pizza and it was in your mall. Like, it wasn't like there was another pizza place in the mall.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's the one you went with.
I occasionally went out of my way to go all the way to the Sbarro's there at the Scottsdale Mall.
That's a long drive for you.
No, I think I mostly went there when I was going to school in Scottsdale. But it was still, you know, solid 15-minute drive to get there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, everything in Arizona is so far away from everything else in Arizona.
This is true. I went and returned a camera the other day. And I think I was in the rental place all of like 4 minutes. And the round trip was like an hour 45.
Where was that in town exactly?
Scottsdale.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is everything so painful for you because you're in that weird little valley nook? Cranny? You're in the cranny of Phoenix?
It doesn't help. I think the cranny Phoenix area adds at least, you know, 15, well, probably more like 10 minutes to every other sort of commute, plus, you know, we're kind of on the south side in general. If I was smart, I would live in Tempe, but then everything's really old, dirty, and full of hippie college kids that just, you know, smoke drugs all the time.
the marijuana and whatnot?
I mean, the, you know, all of it.
Yeah.
It's just it's vape city over there, too.
Oh, vaping's the worst. What I hate is when you walk by like a vape lounge, a vape bar, and there are the people that are like in there and they're hanging out, because I think it's just like they know they won't be judged by other people who are also in a vape store, so they feel like they can freely vape in there. They don't want to do it like outside.
There is a place that used to be a cigar store that I think there's still like a small portion of it, the cigar store. And cigar store, again, is one of those horrible, disgusting places where you can actually smoke cigars indoors. But the majority of it, like 90% of the building, has been converted into like a vape lounge, where it basically just looks like a Starbucks, but like a really old rundown Starbucks with just like depressed people sitting inside with their laptops on tables vaping.
Ugh.
So a lot of coals.
Ugh. Gross. I also don't like cigar stores either. I walked past one the other day and it just, you know, it smells like you're burning a library. It's just, it's hard to describe. It's like musty and smoky all at once.
I mean, you forget how bad it is to be anywhere where people are smoking indoors, let alone a place that is required to have the door shut full of lots of people smoking cigars. It's like, I don't think I could stand in there for more than 4 minutes before I needed to go outside and like get some actual air.
I know. If only you could use your Spear of Osiris to take out the store owner, and then it would collapse the whole place in on itself in one big black ball of smoke. And you'd be safe.
I gotta tell you, if I had a Spear of Osiris, I would use it on a lot of people.
Oh, damn. That's not nice to say you would murder people.
It's not murder. It's, you know, I'm taking over their collective armies of Anubis.
Oh, what's the plural of that?
Anubi?
Is it armies of Anubi, or is it armies Anubis?
I think it would be armies of Anubis, because there's only one Anubis, the god, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you go and sort of, what's the space Egypt movie?
Was it Gods of Egypt or something?
No, the old one that we were talking about.
Oh, Stargate.
Stargate. Unless you're going Stargate, and then you got like fake Anubises with hats on.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be armies, the multiple armies of Anubis.
Why does he have different armies though? He's the same guy. Wouldn't he want to just run it all as one big franchise?
You know, I think it was more just you strategically place your sand armies all around the earth, and then, you know, without line of sight or like cell phones or satellite phones, they can't really communicate. So they kind of all just sort of follow the lead of local, people in charge. So everyone's got their like local factions of armies of Anubis. But I mean, they all basically have the same credo, just, you know, wipe out humanity and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I guess if you have difficulty communicating, you need to have that granular management structure for your sand. Granular. Sand grain.
I hope you're proud of yourself.
I don't, not really. Let's wrap this thing up, I guess.
The Mummy returned for a second time. They did a lot of stupid things. There was a third one, and then some spinoffs, and there's going to be a new one. Did we mention that last time there's going to be a new one?
No. Who got confused and greenlit that?
Tom Cruise is in it, if I recall.
Oh,
I'm actually going to type on the internet. Sorry, hang on.
What?
I'm typing on my loud keyboard. So, 2017. It's called The Mummy. I think it might actually be a reboot. But
yes. Now I remember. This is
we mentioned this?
Reboot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're not gonna revisit this necessarily. Right.
Well, I mean, you know. Oh Jesus! It's got Jake Johnson in it. I missed that. It was so great in Jurassic World.
Yep. Maybe he'll wear a mummy t-shirt and say that, you know, nobody respects mummy, the old mummy t-shirt park, something.
You think he'll be awkward yet slightly adorable at the same time?
One can only hope.
Yeah.
And then he'll like move in for the kiss and then, you know, oh no, got a boyfriend back home.
Maybe he'll go to kiss the mummy because the mummy is played by the chick who played the knife leg lady in Kingsman, which you also haven't seen, but yeah.
Anyway, it's a franchise full of rich opportunities. And now that
Russell Crowe's character is Dr. Henry Jekyll, which I'm sure is completely unrelated. And then
as in Hyde?
I don't know. What's his name? Henry?
I can't remember. Yeah, but I mean, Universal theoretically has all the old monstery kind of stuff in their wheelhouse that they like to do. We should mention that Stephen Sommers went on to direct Van Helsing after this, which is sort of like The Mummy and The Mummy Returns combined together on steroids without anything likable in it. So it's a sort of an amazing monstrosity of a film. And it touches on all of the other Universal monsters that they have in their little vault of bad decisions.
It reminded me of a like a story that you would find in the back of a cereal box.
Like Count Chocula and Frankenberry.
Yeah, like you're eating your cereal and you spin it around and there's like some cartoon drawings of characters like doing stuff. That's what Van Helsing felt like to me.
Especially that part where he's sort of a werewolf fighting a giant bat thing to the death in the thing with the stuff and through the rafters, they're bouncing around like video game characters. That part. Anyway, not that that's burned into my mind, and hopefully I didn't spoil the movie for anybody who hadn't gotten around to seeing Van Helsing yet, but joke's on you. Maybe we'll talk about that at some point. And it also has Kate Beckinsale in it, who's in the Underworld films.
Yeah, because she's married to that guy.
Yeah, a lot of bad decisions that she made to get in these things.
Nah. The Mummy Returns. That's a good description.
Yep.
The end.
And how.